Welcome, everybody. This is the first lecture for the spring 2012 edition of the Mises Academy online class, Principles of Economics, with me, your lecturer, Robert Murphy. And the what we're going to do in this class is going to be 8 classes, and we're going to go through my textbook, Lessons for the Young Economist. I think most people hearing this probably already know, but in case you don't, the book is available for free, the PDF, and there's also an HTML version if you just Google Lessons for Young Economist, Robert Murphy PDF or something like that, you'll be able to get it. So you don't need to buy the book, although, of course, it's a handsome little volume if you do want to buy it from the Mises Institute. What we're going to do in this opening lecture here, I'm going to have to spend a few minutes up front just walking through the mechanics of a Mises Academy class because there are some people that this is the first time they've taken it. So just bear with me if you're an old pro at this, but we don't want to leave people confused. So the way this works is every lecture I will start, and I'll start walking through a PowerPoint slide. So right now you should be able to see and hear me and see the PowerPoint slide. There's also, you can get this locally. In other words, the TAs before the class starts will send out an email blast, and then they also posted it in the chat box here within this WebEx environment to download the PowerPoint slides. I'm going to be writing on the slides with the pen, I don't know what you call it, bamboo technology, and so the slides will be different by the time the lecture is over, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a second. So why don't I go ahead and get to the first real slide here, how the course works. And let me just, this is going to be a little scattershot, let me just throw out some things here. So every Wednesday, oops, bear with me here, let me get this pen going. Okay, Wednesday, live lecture. And don't worry, I'm going to get a lot better at writing with this thing as this goes on. All right, people assure me it just takes a little bit of practice, so this will get quicker. And the reason we're doing introducing the tablet here is when we start using graphs, which we're going to get into fairly quickly in this course, then it's going to really be a lot easier for me to be able to draw stuff out in real time. All right, so I apologize. The handwriting is going to be almost illegible at first, but it'll just make you really believe that I am a doctor. Okay, Wednesday live lectures. Then what's going to happen for people who want to take them, there's going to be quizzes that get posted on Fridays. Okay, so let me just be clear, you don't need to do anything if you don't want to take the class for credit, okay? But some people, when this class is over, want to have a grade that I give you. So every Friday, I'm going to post a quiz, and you have 1 week to actually do it for almost a week. It's like 6 days, all right? So this will all be clear. It'll always be in the email. Let me also just stress, if you aren't getting emails once or twice a week from me regarding this class, then something's wrong, assuming you want to get the emails. And so, you know, make sure that you inquire with somebody about that. The TA for this class is James Cochran. And what you do is do TA at Mises.org. Okay, so that's an at sign right there. TA at Mises.org is whenever you have any kind of technical issue, that's where you want to send it. So if you're trying to log in and it doesn't work, after the fact, if you're trying to watch a recorded lecture and it's not, you know, you can't figure out how to do it, that sort of thing, email that address and the TA for this class will get back to you, because I frankly probably wouldn't even know the answer. So you don't want to direct those. If you have a question about the content, you can send it to me. My email is RPM at consulting by RPM.com. Okay. As far as, so there'll be a quiz every week, and then there'll be a final at the end, and I'll give you more details about those when they become relevant. So again, just to repeat, if you are taking the class for credit, what's going to happen is, like this coming Friday, 2 days from now, the quiz will be posted, and you'll get an email telling you when it's ready, and then you will have up and through the following Thursday in which to take it. All right, it'll be a real quick quiz. It'll be multiple choice, so you don't have to take it on Friday. The point is it becomes available on Friday, and then you have all through the following Thursday to take it, and that will be the week one quiz, and then that'll happen every week, and then at the end there'll be a final. Okay, but I'll give you more information about that when it gets closer. The last thing is on Saturdays there will be what I call office hours, meaning, and those are not mandatory. You don't have to let those, purely to help you guys. So that's just an hour session where it's like an open forum, and I'll just be, you know, have a live camera on, and you guys can ask me whatever questions you want. As far as the way to handle yourself and communicate during the live lectures, like we're doing right now, there's a chat box, and that's for you guys to, you know, just talk to each other and, hey, anyone in here from Tuscaloosa and that kind of stuff. Then there's a separate thing called Q&A. So we just ask to keep things manageable. In the Q&A box, don't be, you know, making jokes to each other or whatever, because it's not that we care. It's just that if you post stuff and there's a bunch of you logged in, it makes the text scroll up. And so if I'm reading questions and you guys are all passing jokes back and forth and, you know, oh my gosh, I can't believe he picked that pie, then I can't, you know, I have to keep scrolling back up, right? So again, it's totally fine and permissible and encouraged for you guys to have side conversations, but do that in the chat box. Reserve your questions for me. So while I'm talking, I'm not going to be able to look at the Q&A really, because I'll get into the rhythm and I'm not going to see it. But so if I say something during the lecture that you don't understand or you want me to elaborate on, just go ahead and type that in the Q&A, and then at the end of the class I'll, you know, open that window and start fielding the questions there. Let me just say, this particular lecture right now, I'm probably at the end not going to have time to get to the Q&A. I bet you we're going to go to the end, and I'm just going to have to stop, because David Gordon, I think, has a class right after us, so I have to end right on the dot when the thing officially ends. And this class used to be 10 weeks, and we're condensing it into 8 weeks. So tonight, I'm actually covering some of the material that in a previous version of this course, you know, would have been spread out over two classes. So the point is, I got a lot of material to go through tonight, so chances are I'm not going to end up at the Q&A thing. Okay. Why don't I just go ahead and – one last thing. All this stuff is always recorded, so if in a particular week you miss the lecture, you just go to the Moodle website and you should be able to get it there. They become available generally within 48 hours or so after the thing occurs. You can download it. Okay, so how do we develop economic principles? This is from the I'm going to be covering some material up front here that's from the first two chapters of the textbook. So if you haven't read that stuff, then some of this might be a little bit foreign to you. Let me just also say, you'll probably get the most out of this class if you do the reading beforehand. So this is the first lecture. Maybe you didn't know going into this one, but going forward, if you can, try to do the reading for a given week before you hear the Wednesday lecture, because it'll make a lot more sense if you hear it, if you read it first and then hear me talk about it. All right, so the first thing, and I should be clear here that we are, this class is not strictly speaking in Austrian economics. This is just a broader, more generic introduction to what you could call free market economic principles. everything we've seen here is consistent with Austrian economics, but my point is when I wrote Lessons for the Young Economist, I didn't want to be needlessly sectarian, right? The kind of stuff we felt at the Institute that the junior high student, let's say, needed to get out of the book, we didn't have to go out of our way to say, and these are particular points that Mises or Hayek would stress as opposed to Milton Friedman, right? So that's, so in general, everything I say in this class, any sort of free market economist would probably agree with. The major exception to that is this upfront stuff that we're going to go over right now, because the Austrian school and tends to, and here I'm just going to be giving you the basic version of Ludwig von Mises' approach to economics. And the reason I do this is just, I think the Austrians are have the best, you call it, philosophical foundation of what economics is, and I think there is a room for, at least before we jump into it and start doing economics per se, you know, before we start getting into the meat of it, to just give a sort of general overview of what is economics and where does it, how does it relate to other things, and where do economic principles come from. Okay, so for the Austrians, a major distinction they would make is purposeful action versus mindless behavior. All right, so action. Let me do a little better. Where, so this is, it's purposeful. Okay, so it's using means to achieve an end. Okay, so it doesn't have to be some long, deliberate, thought-out thing, right? So it doesn't have to be something like someone starts a business, or someone decides he's going to plan a wedding, or someone decides to buy a ticket to go visit Europe in the coming months. I mean, those things are actions, but my point is it could be something fairly immediate, but the point is we as the outsider looking at it interpret it as someone deliberately using means to achieve an end, okay? And I think the easiest way to understand the difference is an example of just pure behavior. An example of that might be a sneeze, right? Or, you know, leg up reflex. Okay, so when the doctor hits your kneecap with a little hammer and your leg goes up, it would be a little bit awkward to say, oh gee, why did the person do that? Right? What was the person trying to achieve by doing that? You say, well, no, it's a reflex. The person wasn't trying to achieve anything. In contrast, suppose the doctor comes up to the person and gets right in close to his face and says, you know, you're the ugliest patient I've ever laid eyes on, and then you kick him in the shin, and then somebody says, what was the purpose of you lifting your leg like that? You'd say, oh, because I wanted to hurt the doctor because he insulted me. You see the difference? I mean, I'm giving you a silly example, but I'm just trying to make you see the distinction. All right, so for Mises and the people who follow in his footsteps in this regard, economics has to do with the logical consequences of the fact that people act. Right, so he's trying to develop a sort of a science around that fact, right? And it's a very general approach. It doesn't matter the content of the action. It doesn't matter what sorts of things people are trying to achieve. Mises just thought, there's this thing called action, that we as social scientists look at things and we see one way of interpreting the world is that we start attributing motivations to people and we start thinking that they have goals. And I see some people in the comments are familiar. The official term Mises uses is called praxeology. That's the science of human action. And then economics is a subset of that. Okay, but I don't want to get too deep into that stuff because we don't need it for this class. I'm just trying to give you a general background. So now, having said that, the Austrians, they make a distinction between social and natural sciences. And without getting too deeply into it, again, there's more of this stuff in the opening chapters of the textbook if you want to read more. But for tonight, let me just warn you that mainstream economists tend to think that the way you advance economic knowledge or economic science is analogous to the way a physicist does it or a chemist. So you probably learned in grade school something called the scientific method. And how does that work? So, oh, well, there's a hypothesis that somebody comes up with, and then they go out and they run some experiments or they collect some data, and then they see, the hypothesis generates predictions, and then they compare the actual data or observations against the prediction generated by the hypothesis, and they see how closely does it fit. And if it's not even close, well, then they reject that hypothesis. That can't be right. And if it is pretty good fit, then they say, well, this, you know, it's an open question still, but this hypothesis might be correct. And the more the hypothesis gets verified, different scientists try different experiments, after a while, they might call it a law, right? So I'm simplifying greatly, but that's you probably learned some version of that in school when you were younger as to this is how science progresses. So Mises and other Austrians caution that that approach might not work so well in economics because it is the social science. And there's lots of reasons for why that distinction is important. I don't want to get into them tonight just because we have so much other material to cover. Again, I get into it more in the textbook in the earlier chapters. But just to give you some food for thought, just step back for a second and think about it. Which scientific fields are very prestigious? Well, you've got things like physicists and astronomers and chemists and medical doctors for the most part, you know, researchers trying to cure cancer, stuff like that. You know, someone comes up with a vaccine, that sort of thing. You know, those are all respected, even by layperson, right? It's not that there's a chemist walking down the street and somebody's going to say, oh, yeah, those chemists, they don't know what they're talking about. Whereas, which fields are not well respected by the public? It's economists, right? You tell someone you're an economist, first of all, they're going to think you're boring, but secondly, they're probably going to think you're a shyster, right? They're going to just think that, you know, you're paid to say whatever you're supposed to say, and oh my gosh, you know, just think of all the jokes about economists, things like if you took all the economists of the world and you laid them end to end, you wouldn't reach a conclusion, or Harry Truman apparently once said he wanted to only have on his staff one-armed economists because he was so sick of them saying to him, on the other hand, okay? So the point is economists are not held in high regard by the public, and there's a sense in which people think economists aren't really scientists the way physicists are or chemists are. And then even worse than economists are sociologists or, heaven forbid, psychiatrists, right? And so you could talk about Freudian psychology or psychiatry, and I guess psychology, I should have said, Freudianism and things like that. So notice in particular, a lot of smart people would think that economics as a whole took a wrong turn, that and it doesn't matter what your political view is. So if you tend to be free market, you would say Keynesian economics was horrible. If you're somebody like Paul Krugman, who's a Keynesian economist, you might say the resurgence of the rational Chicago school approach in the 70s and 80s was a horrible turn that the economics profession took. And if you're a student of psychology, you might say that, oh my gosh, the influence of Sigmund Freud was awful, and everyone's now talking about, their mother and stuff like that. And everybody's, you see what I'm saying? There's nothing like that in the natural sciences. You don't hear too many people saying, yeah, physics was on a great course until that guy Isaac Newton came along and ruined it, or it was going on a great course until Einstein came along and set it back 50 years. Right? I mean, there are oddballs who say stuff like that, but the point is that most people don't talk like that. There's this sense in which it seems like the natural sciences just keep getting better and better and just keep refining their approaches, whereas the social sciences, it doesn't seem like there's that built-in improvement. And the Austrians, the followers of Mises, think that that's not a coincidence and that it's wrong for the people in the social sciences to try to copy the methods of the natural science scientists. All right, so what might it look like? What does Mises have to say about developing basic economic principles? Well, he says that you start with the axiom, the fact that people act, right? We talked about that earlier, and then you just start deducing logically implications from that. Right? Now, let me just say the side note here. I know we have a wide spectrum of people who have tuned into this class, so it's a little bit difficult for me to choose the audience here. We've got 14-year-old homeschool students listening right now, and I know we've also got 35-year-old business people listening. So, I have to grapple with that and try to not bore one group and so forth. So this opening lecture, I might be letting some words slip out, like some terminology and whatever that you're not familiar with. Just bear with me. This will, as we get into the meat of the course, it'll just be standard economic stuff, and the examples will all be very familiar to you. This opening lecture, because we're talking about sort of big picture, what is economics, how do we do economics, this might be a little bit abstract for some of you. Okay, but on the other hand, some of you might really like this because now it gives you a grounding. All right, so like I say, if we're not going to use experiments to test economics. And so the point is, what I'm going to be teaching you in this class, I have no problem calling them economic laws. All right, I think it may be a more appropriate term is principles. But the point is, this stuff is solid and useful, and I think you will understand the world better having learned the things I'm going to teach you in this course. Just like a physicist would think he understands a lot about the world, and oh, if you don't know anything about physics, come take a class from me and I'll teach you the basics, and you're going to just now look out at the world and be able to understand stuff. So in that respect, economics is a science. But the point is, and this is what I've been trying to get at in the last 10 minutes with you guys, if you push it further and say, well, how does the physicist know that what he's teaching is right, and how does the economist know that these so-called laws or principles make sense and so forth, here is where Mises, and I agree with him, says the way you justify these things and the way you prove them is totally different. So we already saw the way the physicist would do it. The physicist would say, well, if you're asking me to justify these so-called laws of nature that I'm teaching to my students, I would just refer you to all the experiments that have confirmed these laws, right? So the law says if you have some conditions, this will lead to predicted outcomes, and then we can go run the experiment and see, does nature actually obey these laws that I'm teaching in the classroom? And lo and behold, it seems like nature does obey the laws. So That's where I think I'm right, and that's why I think this is a useful class for you to take. I'm saying economists don't do that, certainly not at the principles level. The stuff I'm going to teach you in this course, it wouldn't even make sense to go try to test it. That it's more just thinking through the logical implications of the fact that people had purposes and they're trying to use means to achieve ends. Okay, so let me give you an analogy from geometry. If you don't spend too much time on this, if this doesn't work for you, then don't worry about it. But this is what Austrians a lot of times use to try to get people to see that this actually makes sense, because the point is what we are saying the right thing to do to teach economic principles and to convey economic principles and discover them, that's actually what mathematicians do. So in the case of geometry, I'm assuming a lot of you have heard of the Pythagorean theorem, right? So you got a right triangle, so that's supposed to be a right triangle. You got the three sides. Oops, I should make this C, never mind. Right? So it's A squared plus B squared equals C squared. All right? So that's, I see some clever jokes in the chat box. That's assuming these were actually straight lines and there were 180 degrees inside that triangle and the angle, interior angles. That would be a right triangle, and this is standard Euclidean geometry. And the Pythagorean theorem, probably one of the most famous things you would learn in geometry, says A squared plus B squared equals C squared, right, where those letters are the lengths of the sides of the triangle, right? Now, how would you prove something like that, right? So you're in math class, and your geometry teacher draws this on the board and says, this is a true statement. We as mathematicians, we know that that's true. And so you wonder, how could you know that that's true? And one thing you could do is you might take out a ruler and just go around and start measuring the triangles you see in the world, and then getting out a calculator and, you know, measuring the three sides and then writing down the calculator and squaring each thing and then adding the two up and saying, yep, looks about right. And it wouldn't be exact, but you would say, well, it's probably because my ruler's not perfectly correct or some measurement error, but it looks pretty close and so forth. But the point is there, you know, that's not really what mathematicians do, because you wouldn't really know. You would just know at best all the triangles that I've ever encountered that are right triangles seem to obey this principle. But an actual mathematician is much more confident that the Pythagorean theorem is true, because he or she would say, I can prove it. And by proving it, the mathematician doesn't mean, oh, I went out and I did a bunch of experiments and I am really confident because I've never seen a counterexample. That's not what they mean. They would go through and literally prove it. I'm not going to do an actual proof here because this isn't a math class, but I mean, they might, just to give you an idea, they would do something like this. So they would say, okay, there's your triangle. Now start drawing more shapes. So here, there's a square, and that is side A, right? So I just do a square here that's as wide as this triangle is tall, and then they would do a similar thing here. I'm not going to have the room to do it. It would go off the screen. The thing up there that was, you know, C. And then this thing here, which is B. Okay, so you see what I did there? I'm drawing squares that are like on the outside of this triangle, so that now the area of this square is A squared, because it's, you know, A times A, and this is the area of this square is B squared, because it's B times B, and this thing is C squared, because it's C times C. And then if you just physically start moving these shapes around, you can convince yourself that the you know, the interior area of these two little squares added together is exactly equal to the bigger square. All right, that's one way you could go about proving this thing, sort of like as a picture. And there's different ways you could do it, but the point is, assuming I went through that demonstration with you, I would have shown you that for any triangle that we just arbitrarily label the sides A, B, and C, and then start doing this demonstration, I can show you it has to be true that A squared plus B squared equals C squared. End of story. And so once, you know, assuming that I did that proof properly, and you followed the argument and you understood what I was saying, and it, you know, if it hit you, and you said, oh, I see what you mean now, once I had shown you that, that would forever be part of your knowledge of reality, right? And so then if somebody said to you, well, why don't you go test that? I mean, you could do it, but you would know the test was going to be true, right? And if it didn't come back true, you would think that you measured a triangle wrong. You wouldn't doubt that Pythagorean theorem is true because you saw a proof of it, right? So this is a really, and the reason I walked through this is I think this is a great analogy for what we're doing in economics, because here, you just think about, it's kind of astounding when you just step back and think about what we're saying here. Just by thinking about something and by drawing some lines on the blackboard and running through some logical arguments with our mind, just to start with some initial premises or definitions, like to say, what do we mean by a straight line? What do we mean by a right triangle? What do we mean by an angle? And those sorts of things. What do we mean by the notion of square? You know, once we just define what we mean by those terms, it's sort of like the nature of reality just forces that result to pop out. And it's not that we, you know, it's not like we're telling a story. It seems like it's more concrete than that. It's more constrained. That just once we just start thinking about the way reality is and we start defining what we mean by a triangle and so on, this result that Pythagoras discovered and that we call the Pythagorean theorem just leaps out at us, right? It's not like, it's not some arbitrary thing. And you see, it's, so in a sense, it seems like that's coming from reality, that we're discovering it, and yet we're not going out and testing it. It's not like we have to go use a microscope or use a meter stick and go measure the real world. We don't need our sense data. We don't need to use our eyes or our ears or our sense of touch or to smell. We don't need any of that information to help us discover this fact about reality. Okay, and I'm spending some time on this because I'm really trying to get you to just shake you out of your, you know, because this stuff probably seems normal to you because we all know what geometry is. But I'm really trying to make you think about it in a way you've never heard about it before, because it's kind of astounding. Why is reality like this? That just us sitting around thinking about stuff can help us discover deep truths about the way the universe is. And the thing is, so you might think, oh, okay, but just us sitting around thinking, that can't be practical, right? In order to do something practical, you got to go out and get your hands dirty. You got to go out and see the world. You can't just sit in your closet and think stuff. You have to go out and see the world to discover how it is. But yet, geometry is incredibly useful, right? There's a reason we teach geometry. It's not because it's intrinsically beautiful. It's because it's incredibly practical. That you can't build a bridge if you don't know geometry. You have to know a bunch of other stuff that is dependent on, you know, your sensory experiences and so forth. But the point is, it's necessary to have gone through these just mind-churning operations or exercises to develop just pure thought along these lines. It's necessary for today's engineers and architects to make sure tomorrow's engineers and architects go through these same patterns of thought. Right, that's very interesting when you think about it like that. Okay, so if I've gotten you to understand now kind of what geometry is and how we develop geometrical laws, if you want to call them that, and yet they're entirely useful and practical, that's what I'm saying economic principles are like. In this course, I'm going to just teach you a bunch of laws or principles about this is the way an economist approaches a certain situation, or this is the way an economist thinks about this sort of thing. And you're going to notice it's not like I'm ever leaving myself open to being refuted. It's not like I'm going to make a prediction and say, I think next week gas prices are going to be this. And then if gas prices don't turn out to be that way, you guys can say, aha, you don't know what you're talking about, Murphy. I'm never going to be vulnerable like that, because the things I'm going to teach you, you're going to see they're valid internally, just thinking through the logic of what I'm talking about. Just like with the Pythagorean theorem, the geometry teacher doesn't ever need to worry about a student going out and saying, whoa, I found a counterexample. There can't be a counterexample. So then the only issue is going to be now, the stuff I'm teaching you in this course, is it practical? Is it useful to you? Are you going to be glad that you now have this toolkit, this way of looking at the world under your belt to deploy it in certain situations? Right? And, you know, even for geometry, a lot of people might have been forced to learn the Pythagorean theorem and all kinds of other stuff, and now their jobs, they think, I never use that stuff. Why the heck did I have to learn that? You know, you might think the same thing with economics. Who knows? But the point is, I just wanted to be clear on the nature of economic principles. And so this is, like I say, the stuff I just spent a few minutes on there is distinctly Austrian, but I think it's important just to give you that grounding. Okay, next slide, slide 3. Action is a viewpoint. Here, I'm trying to stress, when I talk about action, again, I mean action as purposeful behavior, that we, observing somebody, try to, the way we make sense of it, the way we explain it, is to say, oh, there is a mind at work there. So let me just make sure you see that distinction again. I alluded to it before, but if a physicist could be watching the scene, and we're watching a baseball game, a physicist could describe what's going on and saying, oh, the ball was traveling at a certain velocity, the bat hit it with a certain amount of force and so on, you know, force was applied to the ball, then it momentum was conserved and this, that, and the other thing, or conservation of energy, da 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 da. You could talk through it like that and talk about the air friction and so forth. Right, so the physicist would have plenty of true statements to make regarding the events that were occurring in front of his or her eyes. And say, this is what the natural science of physics has to say about this unfolding situation. And other people could say different things. As a social scientist, you know, what can you say? You could say, well, what happened there is the pitcher was trying to strike the batter out, and the batter's trying to get on base. And then if you could push it further and say, well, be more specific, oh, well, he's trying to hit the ball where the outfielders aren't. Okay? Or, you know, if he thinks he can, he's trying to hit it out of the park. And so, I mean, as trivial as these things are, I'm just trying to get you to see the distinction there. The social scientist is explaining the situation by saying there are other minds at work. We're attributing motivations. The physicist doesn't say the baseball wants to conserve its energy, and that the baseball, when there's a force applied, the mass wants to accelerate in proportion to the force that was applied. You see what I'm saying? That would be silly. Just like a meteorologist isn't going to say, oh, it's thundering and lightning because the gods are angry. You know, that people don't talk like that. But social scientists talk like that all the time. We have to. So that's what I mean by saying action is a viewpoint, meaning we are deciding looking at a situation that we're going to make sense of it by invoking the existence of other minds at work. And I'm deliberately talking like that. It sounds kind of spooky or something, because I'm just trying, again, to shake us out of our everyday thinking, because we just do that naturally. You know, you're watching a baseball game, it probably never occurred to you that, oh, wow, there's not just mindless matter in motion. There's motivations involved, and there's other egos, and there's other preferences and stuff like that, right? So that's, I just want to be clear as to what we're doing. Okay, now, implications of action. So here I'm going to go back to that geometry analogy. So in geometry, remember what I said, we start out with some definitions or some concepts, and then we just step by step start logically deducing things from those initial, you could call them axioms or assumptions or premises, whatever you want to call them. That's, remember what I said, that's the analogy for what we do in economics. So here, what is the starting point for Mises? He said the starting premise, the starting axiom is people act, that there is human action. Right, so if you've heard of Mises' book titled Human Action, and you thought that was an odd title for an economics book, well, this is shedding some light on why he called it that, right? Because that was his starting point. And now the question is, okay, given that people act, and again, by act we mean that precise notion of purposeful behavior, can we conclude anything from that? And the answer is yes. So one thing right off the bat is only individuals act. And the point here is, again, what did I mean by action? Remember we said, what does action mean? It means purposeful behavior. So if we're going to talk like that, well, then necessarily there must be some being that has the purpose. You see that? So it's almost trivial, but it's important to stress, because a lot of times we don't see people obeying this principle. So, for example, people will say things like, "Oh, in 1941, Japan bombed the United States in a sneak attack." And strictly speaking, that doesn't really make sense. Japan, well, you know, what do you mean by Japan? The country? A country can't bomb something. What does that mean? All right? So if you start refining it, you'd say, oh, really what you mean, or to be more specific, is certain Japanese fighter pilots obeyed the orders from their commanders, who in turn, you know, may have gotten the order from the emperor, or he reluctantly agreed or whatever, to fly their planes and drop bombs on Pearl Harbor, which at the time, you know, was acknowledged by many people around the world to be the sovereign territory of the United States government, you know, that kind of stuff. So you see what I'm saying? That it's things that we normally attribute to some collective thing, actually, usually, to be more precise, we mean that individuals are doing it. All right, another quick deduction from the fact that people act is that we can conclude, okay, so we've sort of broken it up now, that it has to be individuals that are doing these actions. And we can further understand or conclude or deduce that they have preferences. So, you know, here in this diagram, I'm just doing something obvious like flavors, cherry, vanilla, mango, and so on, just to make the point. But the point is to say we're going to interpret an action or something as an action with someone having purposeful behavior, it means they're trying to achieve something. So it means those beings that are acting, they care. they would prefer one thing to happen versus another. So just to give you a simple example, let's say I'm looking at somebody and I see that this hand moves and it encircles and then grips a cylindrical thing that's filled with a liquid, and it raises up in the air and then it tilts like this, and the liquid is drained and it goes inside this collection of cells and it goes down. Most people are going to interpret that if it's a normal situation and you say, hey, what just happened there? They're going to say, oh, that guy was thirsty, so he drank some water there. And if you just keep pushing that, you say, well, what do you mean? That is the explanation. And pretty soon it would come out that, oh, well, the person preferred to drink the water to not drinking the water, right? Because if you didn't have that in the back of your mind, it really wouldn't be an explanation to explain that by saying that the person did it on purpose, right? And then you could speculate and say, well, maybe the person was thirsty and so forth, and believed that the water would quench the thirst and so on. But my point is, in order for you even to go down the path of saying there is a conscious being at work here, and I'm interpreting this behavior as being action, that means you think that that other mind, that that work, has desires or preferences, that it cares whether events unfold one way or the other, because if it didn't care, it wouldn't make any sense for you to explain its behavior as being purposeful. There must be some purpose it's trying to achieve. That's the idea. Okay. Another thing we can deduce is that preferences are subjective. So, and here, this just follows naturally. From the fact that people act, we as social scientists start spinning out these deductions, and we realize that one person's actions are generated by that particular person's mind and preferences, and somebody else's are generated by that person's preferences, and that the preferences themselves are tailored to that individual. Okay? And so different people have different preferences. Some people might think that Ron Paul is great. Other people might think that George W. Bush would be a much better president than Ron Paul. Okay? And we would need to know that to explain people's behavior. Some people might, think that Madonna's not a good singer and that Sinatra's much better. And then I don't understand who could possibly think in terms of comedy, but apparently some people actually like Carrot Top. All right, so the point here is, notice we're not making any sort of statement about we're not taking a position on controversial issues of morality or things like that, right? So to say preferences are subjective, you can believe that you have a strict moral code or ethical code, and that people who don't do what you think is right are immoral, and that's fine. Economics has nothing to say about that. So I'm not here saying, hey, everything's subjective, man. Just do whatever you want. It's all relative. That's not at all what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, as economists, when we start trying to explain people's actions, their purposeful behavior, we're only going to get somewhere in that approach if we acknowledge that people have preferences, and that those preferences have to be discussed in relation to each individual. So each individual has his or her own preferences. That's what I mean when I say they're subjective. I don't mean that nobody is ever allowed to criticize someone else's preferences. So a parent who catches her kid smoking can say, that's bad for you, stop doing that, and I'm going to punish you if I catch you doing that again. It's not like the economists would say, oh, you have no business saying that. That's not at all what we're saying. What we're saying as economists is, if we see one teenager smoking cigarettes and we see another one drinking mineral water, to explain that, we're going to say, oh, that probably isn't a reflex. It's conscious, purposeful behavior, and the teenager smoking the cigarettes thinks it's cool, or, you know, derives pleasure from it or something. Whereas the one drinking the mineral water is really health conscious and is concerned about taking care of his body and so forth, and that's what's really important to him. Right, so the point is just to explain purposeful behavior, we have to invoke the notion that people have preferences and that those preferences can differ from person to person. Okay, I think this is the last slide on this topic. So the last thing that we can deduce from this is that preferences are a ranking. And this will, I don't think I included it for this shortened, you know, 8-week course, but if you want to read the chapter on barter pricing, you'll see why I stress this so much. Right, so if you want to really get into the nuts and bolts of where particular prices come from in a market economy, then you can read that chapter and you'll see why I stress this part here. But in any event, what do I mean by preferences are a ranking? That all we can conclude from seeing people's actions is that they preferred one thing to another. Right? We can't make statements about, oh, that person preferred vanilla to chocolate 86%. Or that person values going to the beach 2.5 times more than studying for the exam. That sort of language cannot be derived from economic principles. All we can do, because again, we're just trying to derive things directly from action. And so in an action, all a person is doing is exhibiting the best choice. And so really all we can conclude is from the nature of action itself, or from the concept itself, all we can really deduce is the thing the person did, he or she judged to be the best option available to the exclusion of the other possibilities. Okay, so now we're into Crusoe economics. I'm going to have to go through this fairly quickly because, again, we got 35 minutes left for tonight's class. And, again, we have to end exactly on time because they got a class right after us. Let me just explain this term here. So, of course, the term comes from this fictional story of Robinson Crusoe, who gets shipwrecked on what he thinks initially is a deserted island, and it's the original story. The modern day version is Tom Hanks in the movie Castaway. If you guys have seen that, Castaway is basically an updated version of Robinson Crusoe, except the one difference is Crusoe eventually finds somebody else on the island, and then that allows for trading. You know, yeah, right, as opposed to the, what was it, a volleyball, the Tom Hanks befriends in the movie. So what we're doing here is we're starting simple, and I want to show you how we can deduce all sorts of vocabulary and economic concepts just thinking through. You know, so already I showed you how we can start spinning out a lot of deductions and results just thinking about the nature of action itself. And so now what we're going to do in the so-called Crusoe economics section is we're going to take a person who exhibits action, and we're going to put him or her in this environment where there are natural resources and things like that, just to sort of get us warmed up and see how many standard economic principles and concepts we can talk about before we then start bringing more people into the analysis. Right? So the point of this isn't that it's not like this is a model of the economy. It's more just a little useful exercise to get you to think properly to then be able to talk about a more complicated situation. All right, so the first thing I want to talk about here is even just with an isolated individual who's in this environment, we can start classifying goods. So first of all, what is a good? A good is something scarce that contributes to the person's achieving certain goals. All right, so remember, the person has preferences, and a good is something that's out there in the real world that the person realizes, oh, I can use that thing to help me achieve my subjective preferences. And we call them, to be a good, we mean that it implies that it's scarce. So I should write that term down. Scarce. Meaning that there's not enough of the good to completely satisfy every possible thing that the person would want to use it for. All right, so if you didn't have that, then you a lot of economists would just say it's not really a good, it's just like a background condition. So, for example, you could say, well, you need there to be oxygen in order to do it, to achieve just about any of your goals, unless you were contemplating suicide or something, you need there to be oxygen, right? So, now, would you call it a good? You could if you wanted to. People might call it a free good, but I think, Rothbard and other Austrian economists would just say, well, it's easier just to call that a background condition of human welfare. Same thing, too. I mean, you could get really absurd and say, well, is it a good that the moon doesn't explode on us or something? There's all kinds of things you could do. Things that have to be true. Is the charge on an electron a good? I mean, that doesn't really make sense, right? That stuff all has to be the way it is, or else we wouldn't be able to achieve most of our goals. But the point is, those are just kind of background conditions. Now, oxygen might be a good, a scarce good, if you're talking about like a deep sea diver, right? Because there, in that situation, the oxygen is not so readily abundant that you don't have to think about it. Or if you're going to go out in outer space or something like that. In that case, yeah, it would be scarce, and you can totally see people economizing on it, where, they had to be careful and use the resource appropriately, and there would probably be, market prices paid for it. Somebody's going to go deep sea diving, he's got to pay somebody to give him tanks full of oxygen before he goes under. Okay, so you can see there the relationship between scarcity and economic behavior, if you want to think about it like that. Okay, but now, given that we have these things called goods that are scarce objects that help us achieve our ends or our goals, we can start classifying them into different categories. So the first major distinction is between producer goods and consumer goods. So consumer goods, let's just start there. That's the easiest one to think about. Those are goods that directly help us achieve our ends. Right? So if you're hungry, an apple is a consumer good because if you have that apple, you can directly consume it and that satisfies your hunger. A television set in most circumstances is going to be a consumer good because that directly satisfies your desire to watch inane programming, to watch The Bachelor and so forth, right? Leisure also would be included in this category. And so that's when you're sort of using your free time just to directly, you know, whatever is directly enjoyable to you at the moment. All right. In contrast to consumer goods, are producer goods. They're also known as the means of production. So here, what is a producer good? So it's still a good. It's still something scarce that helps us achieve our ends, but what makes it a producer good is that it doesn't directly help us achieve our ends. Really what it does, a producer good is useful either in producing other producer goods or in producing consumer goods. And so just to get a little, it's easiest to give you an example. An apple seed is the producer good, but it's not a consumer good for most people. Right? If you're hungry, you can't eat an apple seed. I mean, you could, but most people wouldn't find that a very useful thing to do. But what you can do, but you wouldn't just throw it out and say, oh, this is useless to me because I'm hungry. No, you'd see, wait a minute. If I understand the way the world works and I have a theory, you know, using my mind and my expectations, I think, oh, if I plant this down the road, it's going to produce the consumer good called an apple, and at that time that will help me quench my or satisfy my hunger. That's why the apple seed is itself now a good. And since they're, you know, the earth's not overflowing with apple seeds, they're scarce. We could use more of them. All right. So that's the idea there. And the same thing like the soil that you might plant crops in is a producer good, even though you're not going to eat the dirt. Right? The dirt per se doesn't directly do anything for you, but it's a producer good. Similar thing, a hammer is a producer good for most people because it doesn't directly do anything for you. You build a house, that's a consumer good because the house directly gives you shelter. But the hammer per se, you know, is not going to do too much with a hammer that directly satisfies you or that directly helps you achieve your goals. But it certainly is a very useful thing to have because it allows you to produce a house and other sorts of things that are consumer goods. All right, so that's the distinction between consumer and producer. Now, within this class of producer goods, we can break it down even further. And yeah, we've got some wise guys in the comments saying, what if I'm Thor? Is a hammer a consumer good? Yes. All right, or even if a regular person, somebody breaks into your house and you gotta do what you gotta do with the hammer, you could say in that case it's a consumer good. So these things, it's a good point here that the distinction between producer and consumer good, it's not some objective fact about the object. It depends what you're doing. It depends how you classify it in your mind. What are you using it for? So the example I like to give here is somebody's sitting on this on a porch strumming his guitar. At that point, it's a consumer good. If the person's just doing it because it gives him enjoyment to hear the tunes and so forth that he's able to crank out with that thing. But then people are walking by and they say, oh, I like that, and they start throwing money into his hat or something. And now he realizes, oh, wait a minute, I can use this guitar as a means to acquire more money. And so if that's the way now he's viewing the guitar, he's not looking at it as, oh, this is something that satisfies my preference to hear nice music, but rather this is a way I can obtain money, and then I can go use the money to buy tuna fish, which satisfies my hunger. Now he's looking at the guitar as a tool that helps him ultimately satisfy his hunger, but not directly, because he's not going to eat the guitar. Right? So the same physical thing switch from being a consumer good to a producer good just because of the way this guy's classifying it with his mind and the intentions he has for it. All right. So back to this thing, though. Producer goods, we can break it down into three categories. the first one's land, also known as natural resources. So this is anything that is a gift of nature. So it's literal, you know, land like farmland, that's an obvious one, but it's also things like minerals, you know, coal deposits, a flowing river that has fish in it and stuff like that. The next one, labor, that of course is the contribution of workers with their bodies and, you know, the skills they can deploy, you know, using their mind to control their bodily movements. That's what labor is. And then finally is capital goods. Now that, it's producer goods that are man-made or human-made, if you want to be more accurate and fair to both sexes there, right? So it's a producer good that people make, in contrast to land or natural resources, which are producer goods that nature gives us. All right, so capital goods are things like tractors, hammers, 18-wheelers, drill presses, stuff like that. It's also things like, I'm trying to think of a good example. Like a bunch of flour that the baker gets. That, yeah, it's you know, big bags of flour or something in the back of an 18-wheeler en route to a baker who's going to then turn it into loaves of bread for the customers. That flour is a capital good, right? So capital goods don't just have to be tools and machines. They can also be things in inventory. Okay, so even like if you're a department store and you have 50 sweaters that are in stock and that are, you know, sitting in the back room there, from your perspective, those are capital goods. Now, when you put them out on the floor and then some customer comes along and takes one and pays for it and walks out of the store, that sweater is now a consumer good to the customer. But from the point of view of the store, while that stuff is still in inventory, it's a capital good. Okay, so again, notice the same thing can be a capital good or a consumer good depending on whose perspective we're talking about. All right, so for Robinson Crusoe, and the story, you haven't read the chapter, I really encourage you to read the chapter, this stuff will make a lot more sense, is the consumer goods are things like the coconut or fish, if there's, you know, running water, the water that he can get and drink, that sort of thing. And if he builds a hut, the hut is a consumer good because it provides shelter services directly. And the producer goods would be obviously like the natural resources would be the trees that yield the coconuts, the wood, the tree branches that then Crusoe can take, use his labor to transform it into a stick. Now that stick is a capital good because it's a tool that he's going to use to knock down coconuts with. And so it's man-made, but yet it's not a consumer good, right? The stick by itself isn't really useful directly except for like back scratching or something like that. The real use of that long stick or pole that Crusoe makes from various materials is that he uses it to knock down coconuts. Okay, now continuing with that, we're now on the slide, income, saving, and investment. So here, again, with the time we have, I can't spend too much on it, but let me just walk you through. So you should understand how income saving and investment work for the isolated person like Robinson Crusoe, because then later on we're just going to generalize that and you're going to see these same principles at work in the broader economy that we're used to. So that these concepts make sense even for Robinson Crusoe, who's all by himself and doesn't use money. And then, but the point is, we get these concepts down, and then later on, we're going to see that the same principles hold true for an economy with millions of people where we're using money. So that's partly why we stress this stuff now. Okay, so the time we have here, I'm trying to hang on. Let me just skip ahead. I just want to remind myself of what else we have to cover. Okay, so I pace myself properly here. Okay, so income saving and investment. What income really says it's the maximum consumption. And like I say, for those who tuned in a little bit late, the handwriting is going to get much better as the course progresses. It's the max consumption, let's say, without getting poorer. In the textbook, I gave you a little bit more of a precise definition, but here I'm just trying to motivate the discussion. Okay, so that's what your income is. So obviously, in the real world now, where you guys live and work and you get a paycheck, you know, we could start talking about income in terms of money. But I'm trying to make you think of it more abstractly and not assume that there's money right away. Because I'm trying to see these are more general principles that will also be true in a world with money. Okay, so what I mean here, so for Robinson Crusoe, the idea is if he starts out with nothing, so he doesn't, you know, he can't get poorer in that sense, right? He's got nothing to start with. His income really is just saying how much can he consume each day or each week, whatever the time period is going to be. So all he has to work with initially is the natural resources, and then his human labor. And so the idea is, if we just think about it in terms of coconuts for now, there's all kinds of other stuff he could be doing, but it's easier just to pick a particular thing. So here his income is just saying, given how many hours a day he can work, because he has to leave some time for sleep to, you know, replenish his body and so forth, how many coconuts a day can he get? And remember, here we're assuming he just crashed on his island. He's got nothing, no tools to work with. So what's he going to do? He has to climb the coconut trees and get the coconuts down that way. So it's a real laborious process, very labor-intensive. And so he can get a certain amount per day. I don't remember the exact numbers that I used in the textbook, but maybe he can get 10 per day. All right, so if that's our example, then it's 10 per day. And so now that, what happens if we say, well, what if, you know, what does Crusoe want to do to improve his situation? Well, he can save some of those coconuts. Now, I mean, again, this is going to be so obvious to us because we know what the word save means in everyday English, but in terms of a formal economic definition, what does saving mean? Saving is consuming less than your income. Okay? So again, saving means consuming less than your income. So if you're thinking of it in terms of money, yeah, your income is $10,000 and you save $2,000, Well, then you could only consume 8,000. Right? You can only spend 8,000 on goodies because you saved 2 of it. So it's obvious in terms of money. What does it mean in terms of, if we're not dealing with money, if we're dealing with something more simple? Well, Crusoe, to say he saved some of his coconuts, well, duh, it means he set some of them aside. He doesn't eat every last coconut that he picked that day or that he gathered. Okay, now, investment, what does that mean? Investment is using resources to try to increase future income. All right, so let me just walk you through the story. So Crusoe here, what is he doing? So he builds up the stockpile of coconuts because he's saving it, and then now he's going to invest his labor and the other resources into making that long pole, right? So he's going to then, once he's built up a stockpile of coconuts, he's going to then take a few days, I don't remember how long I said it took him in the book, to get some sticks and then maybe sharpen them by rubbing them against each other and getting some vines and then putting the sticks together and then wrapping the vines around them and tying them tightly. So now he's built this long pole. And now, augmented with that pole, which is a capital good, now his labor is far more productive. So maybe with the pole, he can get 20 per day. And again, these numbers don't necessarily correspond to what I wrote in the textbook. All right, so notice that with the pole now, his labor is far more physically productive. And so we could say his income now is a lot higher. Okay, so things get a little bit more complicated because now the income is not the full 20 coconuts per day with this pole, because we have to keep in mind that the pole will deteriorate over time, right? It's not an indestructible pole. He keeps using it to walk around whacking coconuts with it day in, day out. Eventually, that the wood's going to splinter or the vines are going to become, withered and so forth. So, strictly speaking, what happens is his income is not the full 20 coconuts, because if he's just eating the 20 coconuts and doing that day after day, the pole is wearing away, and so that's a sense in which he's getting poorer. And so really his income is a little bit less, that he really needs to be either physically setting aside new pieces of new branches and new vines or whatever each day, so that when the first pole is totally worn away, he's now constructed a new pole to replace it. Right, so that's probably the easiest way for you to think about it. So the point is, he really can't just go around and spend his whole waking hours, all of his labor with this new pole, using it to acquire more coconuts, which we said, maybe he can do 20 of those a day. That's actually overstating what his actual income really is, because really what he should do is maybe he knocks off a half an hour early each day, and so he's only getting maybe 19 coconuts, because he's got to take that last half hour to set in motion and be building step by step a little bit more each day, a new pole to replace the first one when it wears out. Okay, and so once he got in that new position, if he kept doing that, he could just maintain that flow of coconut consumption indefinitely, right? Because every day he's setting aside a little bit of time to maintain or to replace the pole to maintain his standard of living. And so that's what his actual income would be. Okay, so what are the general lessons from that little fable I just told you? Well, first of all, we saw the definitions of what income, saving, and investment are, but we also saw the reality of what's called capital depreciation. That's the physical wearing away of the capital good. And so we see how you need to correctly take into account the need to invest to maintain your capital good. And the other thing, the real crucial point is, in order to augment his productivity, in order to make his labor more productive, Crusoe needed to create capital goods. It's not enough. We'd be very poor. Our consumption would be very low if all we had to work with were the gifts of nature and our direct application of labor. What actually happens, the reason humans now have such a higher standard of living than humans living in the year 500 is that we have a lot more capital goods to work with. That humans in those intervening centuries have built all sorts of tools and equipment and other sorts of things that now make our labor far more productive than the labor of somebody back in the year 500. And how are they able to do that? Well, because there was saving all along the way. So that's another crucial thing to take away from that story that I told you, is in order for Crusoe, so let me just put it to you this way. Yes, Crusoe has to be intelligent. Crusoe has to be creative. He has to use his mind to realize the opportunity, to realize, hey, you know what? Instead of me just literally living hand to mouth, day in and day out, just climbing trees and picking coconuts and eating 10 of them a day, I could, I have the physical option, the technological capability of producing, using the branches I see available in the vines to making a pole, which would then allow me to acquire far more coconuts per day than I can do right now with my bare hands. So yeah, that requires his mind and his creativity and his technological know-how, if you want to think of it that. But there's something else it requires in order for him to get into that new position with his higher standard of living, and that is he has to be disciplined. He has to save early on. He has to be willing to forego, to renounce, to give up potential consumption early on in order to then enjoy the flow of greater consumption down the road. So specifically, remember, what we said in this story was, oh, Crusoe first, he's picking 10 a day, but he's only eating, let's say, 8 per day. So each day he's saving 2 coconuts, and that allows him to build up a stockpile so that then when he wants to devote himself wholeheartedly into making that long pole, he has something to eat, right? Because he can't just stop eating for a few days to make the pole. So that's why the savings is necessary. And however you tell the story, you might say, every day he cuts off work early and starts building a little bit more of the pole. You can think of it that way too. Right? Either way, the point is he can't eat 10 coconuts per day and also build the pole. There's a trade-off involved. And so again, from his perspective, what he's doing is he's giving up potential coconut consumption up front. He's only consuming, let's say, 8 per day for a while instead of the possible 10, so that down the road he's going to be much more adequately fed. And so that's why I like these little simplistic Robinson Crusoe stories, because you can see it crystal clear in this silly little story about how there's that trade-off that's coming from just the nature of reality and the way our world works. So you can see physically how it is. If you're willing to cut back on consumption and to save and invest early on, you can have a permanently higher income. So make sure you understand those ideas here, and you'll see that they are also true in an economy with billions of people and money. Okay, we are almost out of time, so let me just very quickly hit these two things. So I apologize. I set my cell phone alarm just to make sure I didn't go over time. So we just got about 3 minutes. I got to wrap this stuff up. Let me just check the Q&A. Okay. Good. So nobody posted the Q&A for tonight because I warned you. Okay, great. So a few minutes. We've got 2 slides left. Goods valued on the margin. I'm looking at slide C, goods valued on the margin. What do I mean by that? That the way to properly do economic analysis and the way that people in practice actually act is they look at what's going to change based on the direct items that are involved. And this will make more sense when I give you an example. Where this term on the margin comes from, it means thinking on the edge. You know, in other words, just look at the things that are being changed that are by a little tweak. Don't look at the whole thing. So if you think about a piece of paper, what's the margin? The margin is on the edge, right? The margin is not the interior of the paper. So the best way to get this across quickly is what was called the water diamond paradox. So here the idea is, you know, why is it that diamonds have a much higher market value than water does, right? So a pound of diamonds has a far higher price than a pound of water, or a gallon, if you want to, you know, depending on what units of measurement you want to use. Why is that? Because, you know, if you think about it, that's weird. Because water is essential for human life, and diamonds really aren't. I mean, they're pretty to look at, and they can be used in drills and stuff like that, but it's kind of weird. And the answer is that we value things on the margin, that you're never faced with a choice between all of the water in the world and all the diamonds in the world. Really what's happening is you are always, like if somebody came up to you and said, hey, it's your lucky day, I got a present for you, you can either have this diamond or you can have this bottle of water, most people are going to pick the diamond because the point is you're choosing between that diamond and that bottle of water. And so it's not true that you need that bottle of water or else you die of thirst. If it were true, if you're out in the middle of the desert and you're just about to collapse and someone comes up to you and says, hey, you want this diamond or this bottle of water, you probably would pick the bottle of water, right? So that's the idea. And so this has to do with what we're calling scarcity and things like that, that the reason water typically has a very low price, that restaurants give it away for free, is that in most situations we have far more water than we need to satisfy our goals at that point. Or we have so much water that we can satisfy most of our goals so that the remaining goals really aren't that important to us, that more water would satisfy. And that's why on the margin, one more unit of water is not as important to us as one more unit of diamonds. Okay, we're actually out of time. And that's fine because this last slide wasn't too critical. So why don't we stop there? Again, just to refresh your memories, I will make sure you're getting the emails that I send out from this. If you're taking the class for credit and you want to make sure you don't miss anything, I will post a quiz on the material we just covered late Thursday night, and the quiz will go active Friday morning. And again, I will send out an email with all the instructions of what you need to do. If you're not taking the class for credit, don't worry, you don't need to tell me, just don't take the quizzes and I'll get the picture. Okay, thanks everyone for tuning in. I hope you enjoy the class. And again, if you have any technical issues, just email ta@mises.org, that stands for teaching assistant, and they'll give you help. And we've got to get out of here now because there's another class coming in right after us. Oh, at mises.com, excuse me, ta@mises.com.